This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Greetings and thanks for joining the programme today. I hope you had a successful and happy week. In the text we're going through, that is Nam Kar Pel's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, we've come to the section on the precepts of mind training. This is essentially a collection of slogans we can bring to mind when we tend to forget we're on the spiritual path and act out of afflictive emotions or karmic imprints. Those will inevitably, of course, lead us to much suffering in the future. In our discussion, we've come to the slogan, "Guard both at the cost of your life," which, as we saw, broadly refers to giving up our lives rather than breaking the two sets of vows we've taken, that is, the commitments of mind training and the set of any other vows we're living by. As I mentioned last time, giving up our life seems an awfully hard thing to do when instead we could just break a vow and continue on merrily into the rest of our life. But the rationale is that this life lasts only a very short time, 100 years at the outside, while the karmic consequences of breaking a vow can afflict us with misery for a very long time, much longer than the 100 years of this life. So, for the long-term benefit, it is better to lose this life than to break the vow. How easy that is, I guess, depends on how firmly we understand the meaning and relevance of the vow, and how much attachment we have to this life. It's also a training to come to the point where we regard the vows as more valuable than our life. For most of us, our life is the most valuable thing we have, and the one thing we are most loath to lose. Nevertheless, history is full of people who have regarded something other than their life as most important and have died for it. So it's not impossible that we can come to the conclusion that nothing is of greater relevance to us than our commitments. In setting up his ashram, Mahatma Gandhi declared a number of rules that members of the ashram were expected to follow. The first is what he called the vow of truth, and this is what he wrote about it. Not truth simply as we ordinarily understand it, not truth which merely answers the saying, honesty is the best policy, implying that if it is not the best policy, we may depart from it. But here, truth as it is conceived means that we have to rule our life by this law of truth at any cost. And in order to satisfy the definition, I have drawn up the celebrated illustration of the life of Prahlad. For the sake of truth as he knew it, he was prepared to die without caring to return the blows that he'd received from his father or from those who were charged with his father's instructions. Not only that, he would not in any way even parry the blows. On the contrary, with a smile on his lips, he underwent the innumerable tortures to which he was subjected, with the result that at last he attained truth. That fact was there, but if he had died in the midst of tortures, he would have still adhered to truth. That is the truth which I would like to follow. In our ashram, we make it a rule that we must say no when we mean no, regardless of consequences. That was Mahatma Gandhi on dying for your truth. I guess we could go further with this particular slogan, guard both at the cost of your life, but let's leave it there now and go on to the next one, which is train in the three difficulties. But before that, let's think about motivation as we normally do. May my participation in this program become the cause for me to attain enlightenment to benefit all beings everywhere. That would be the best motivation, so let's try for that. But if it's not possible, at least think that the program will become a cause for your own full liberation from suffering. Thank you. Now let's look at that next slogan, train in the three difficulties. Pell, in his usually concise way, comments on the three difficulties like this. In the first place, it is hard to remember the remedies for the disturbing emotions. Secondly, it is difficult to oppose them. And thirdly, it is difficult to cut their continuity. Therefore, recognizing the disturbing emotions and mindful of their disadvantages, make efforts through various means to dispel them and put an end to the sequence. So that's Nam Kar Pel, And basically the three difficulties therefore are, first, recognizing the afflictive emotions as they arise, and remembering the specific antidotes to what is arising. The second is applying the antidotes, and the third is to continually apply the antidotes until the emotion no longer afflicts us. Let's look at how Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche comments on the three difficulties, which he calls the three hard disciplines, in his book Enlightened Courage. He says, these are the difficult practices of mindfulness, of expulsion, and of interrupting the flow. As for the first of these, the difficult practice of mindfulness, it is necessary to recognize afflictive emotions as soon as they arise, and it is hard at first to remain sufficiently aware to be able to do this. However, when negative emotions arise, we should identify them as anger, desire, or stupidity. Even when emotions have been recognized, it is not easy to drive them out with the antidote. If, for instance, an uncontrollably strong emotion comes over us, so that we feel helplessly in its power, we should nevertheless confront it and question it. Where are its weapons? Where are its muscles? Where is its great arm in its political strength? We will see that emotions are just insubstantial thoughts, by nature empty. They come from nowhere, they go nowhere, and they remain nowhere. When we are able to repel our defiled emotions, there comes the difficult practice of interrupting the flow. This means that, on the basis of the antidote described, defiled emotions are eliminated just like a bird flying through the air. No trace is left behind. These are the practices in which we should really strive. In his commentary, The 7-Point Mind Training, B. Alan Wallace calls the difficulties austerities and says this about them. Austerity refers to something difficult and arduous. What are these three things that are so difficult to do? The first is bearing in mind the antidotes to mental distortions. The second is turning away from the mental distortions. The third is cutting their continuum. The first austerity is simply to be aware from hour to hour, from moment to moment, of the quality of thoughts that arise in our mind. It is pleasant to savor a mind that is relatively undistorted, with a sense of balance that does not hinge upon external stimuli or even on sucking the conceptual thumb of a pleasant thought. As you become aware, you can ascertain these wholesome states of mind, despite the subtle currents of self-grasping that remain. Then, when this wholesome state becomes distorted, try to remain aware. And this takes some practice. The mental distortions that arise may shape themselves as anger or resentment, dwelling on some abuse or thoughtlessness received, or as anxiety focused on attachment. Whatever form they take, they disrupt the internal harmony of the mind, its poise and clarity. Recognizing these mental distortions as they arise, recollect their antidotes. Shantideva, especially in the 6th chapter of his Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, offers a whole repertoire of very accessible practices. We need not be saints or profound contemplatives to practice these effective antidotes for specific mental distortions, although they can be difficult. The easiest thing to do when a mental distortion arises is to ride with it like a hitchhiker. We are sticking our thumb out in a neutral or wholesome state of mind, and then some guy comes along in a black vehicle of mental distortions, picks us up and carries us away. When a mental distortion arises, we naturally identify with it and go with it. The mind is not aware of the mental distortion, but is focused in the subject of the distortion, the enemy or the thing that we are grasping after. This is the conditioning we have to overcome. The second austerity, after awareness of the antidotes, is to turn away from the mental distortion. Point a finger and say, "All right, anger, resentment, attachment, jealousy, I see you. I know what you're doing to me, and I'm not going along for the ride. Your time is up." It may be a crude response, but it is better than riding with it as a passive victim. Recognize the distortion, recall the specific antidote, apply the antidote, and pull out. Like a jet going into a nosedive, it may be hard to pull against the momentum, but with effort it can be done. The third austerity is cutting the continuum of the mental distortions. This is the hardest of all, but we can start by cultivating a resolve. Once we've recognized the mental distortion and turned away from it, not to succumb to this kind of distortion in the future. The final antidote, of course, is direct realization of the nature of ultimate truth. From a Buddhist perspective, this is the only effective means for ultimately cutting the mental distortions forever, so that they can never afflict us again. The misconstruing of reality through confusion and ignorance lies at the very root of all the other mental distortions. To cut that root, we need to saturate the mind with the experience and not simply the concept of the nature of ultimate reality. And that is B. Alan Wallace. Pema Chodron says in her book Start Where You Are that training the three difficulties is her favorite out of all the mind training slogans. She uses the more modern term neurosis for afflictive emotion. And also, you may remember from the last program that she talks about the big squeeze. We read quite a comprehensive explanation of what she meant by that. But if you can't remember or were not with us, let's read it again, as it's such a good description of the conundrum we're up against when we're taking on the spiritual path. It goes like this. If we want to communicate and we have a strong aspiration to help others, on the level of social action, on the level of our family, at work in our community, or we just want to be there for people when they need us, then sooner or later we're going to experience the big squeeze. Our ideals and the reality of what's really happening don't match. We feel as if we're between the fingers of a big giant who's squeezing us. We find ourselves between a rock and a hard place. There's often a discrepancy between our ideals and what we actually encounter. For instance, with raising children, we have a lot of good ideas, but sometimes it's very challenging to put together all the good ideas with the way our children really are, there at the breakfast table with food all over themselves. Or with meditation. Have you noticed how difficult it is to actually feel emotions without getting totally swept away by them? Or how difficult it is simply to cultivate friendliness towards yourself when you're feeling completely miserable or panicked or caught up? There's a discrepancy between your inspiration and the situation as it presents itself, the immediacy of their situation. It's the rub between these two things, the squeeze between reality and vision, that causes you to grow up, to wake up to be 100% alive and compassionate. The big squeeze is one of the most productive places on the spiritual path, and in particular in this journey of awakening the heart. It's worth talking about, because when we find ourselves in that place again and again, usually we want to run away. Sometimes we want to give up the whole thing. It's like burnout. It feels extremely uncomfortable and you can't wriggle out of it. It's like a dog that gets its teeth in your arm and you just can't shake it off. Times of the big squeeze feel like crisis periods. We have the aspiration to wake up and to help. At the same time, it doesn't seem to work out on our terms. It feels impossible for us to buy our situation and also impossible to throw it out. Being caught in the big squeeze humbles you, and at the same time, it has great vision. And this is the interesting part. It softens you, and yet it has a big perspective. Through meditation practice, we learn not to reject, but also not to grasp. This is the same paradox that we are presented with in our lives. It's not so much that you do or you don't reject, it's more that sometimes you find that you can't do either, or that you do both at the same time. Train in the three difficulties is my favorite slogan because it acknowledges that this part is difficult, all right, but it's a good way to spend our time. There are three difficulties. The first is seeing neurosis as neurosis, and the second is being willing to do something different. The third difficulty is the aspiration to make this a way of life. The first difficulty is to see what you do. There's a slogan that goes along with that that says, liberate yourself by examining and analyzing. This is an interesting point, to be able to see what we do without hating ourselves. And this can be a description of Maitri, loving kindness. We could see what we do with honesty, but with gentleness. We could see what we do and realize that that's our first experience of the big squeeze. It's the path of a warrior, seeing what we do without turning it against ourselves. This slogan about liberating yourself by examining and analyzing simply means, as with the slogans, don't be jealous, don't be frivolous, and don't wallow in self-pity, that the first step is to see yourself jealous, see yourself frivolous, see yourself wallowing in self-pity. You think to yourself, well, what would Dr. Seuss do in this situation? Instead of using it as ammunition against yourself, you can lighten up and realize it's the information that you need in order to keep your heart open. If everybody on the planet could experience seeing what they do with gentleness, everything would start to turn around very fast, even if we didn't get to the second difficulty. The second difficulty is to do something different. Even if you see what you do, can you then do something different? If you're jealous, can you snap your fingers and no longer be jealous? We all know it's more difficult than that. You're sitting there and your boyfriend is sitting across the room with somebody else having a really good time, and you're getting more jealous and furious by the minute. There's a little bird on your shoulder who says, okay, here's your big chance. You could use this to wake up. And you say, forget it. He's really a creep. I want to be mad at him. He deserves my anger. Now the little bird is jumping up and down saying, hey, don't you remember? Don't you remember you're saying, I don't believe this stuff. I am right to be jealous and he's horrible. There you are. The little bird jumps onto your other shoulder, pulls on your earlobe and says, come on, give yourself a break. Get to know this stuff. Drop the storyline. Forget it, you say. Boy, are you stubborn. Pema Chodron continues, that's what I find about myself. Even when we're given the methods for how to give ourselves a break, we're so stubborn. If you think smoking is hard to give up, try giving up your habitual patterns. It leaves you with the same kind of queasy feeling that you have when giving up any other addiction. So instead of liberating yourself by examining and analyzing, the habitual response to seeing yourself clearly is to take the wrong medicine. You inflame the jealousy. You wallow more in self-pity. You speed up the frivolity. Usually we do this by talking to ourselves. It's like a bellows fanning a fire. We just sit there and we have fantasies about our boyfriend leaving the party with our friend. Or we talk to ourselves about how hopeless it is and how we always feel like this and how it's never going to get better. Do something different, such as Tonglen. Anything different would help, anything that's not habitual. For example, you could go up and take a cold shower and sing at the top of your lungs, or drink a glass of water from the wrong side like you do when you're trying to get rid of hiccups. But even if you see what you do, and even if you do something different, the third difficulty is that it's difficult to continue that way, to cut the habitual pattern as a way of life. So whenever you see yourself spinning off in some kind of habitual way, you could aspire to catch yourself and do something different as a way of cultivating compassion for yourself and compassion for others. But don't be surprised or give up when it's difficult. Pema Chodron then recommends bringing in other slogans from the same text to help us deal with the three difficulties. She says, a slogan that encourages practicing the three difficulties is two activities, one at the beginning, one at the end. At the beginning of your day when you wake up, express your aspiration. May I practice the three difficulties. May I see what I do. When it happens, may I do something different. And may that be a way of life for me. At the beginning of your day, using your own language, you could encourage yourself to keep your heart open, to remain curious, no matter how difficult things get. Then, at the end of the day, when you're just about to go to sleep, review the day. Rather than using what happened as ammunition for feeling bad about yourself, about how the whole day went by and you never once remembered what you'd aspired to do in the morning, you can simply use it as an opportunity to get you to know yourself better and to see all the funny ways in which you trick yourself, all the ways in which you're so good at zoning out and shutting down. If you feel like you don't want to practice the three difficulties anymore because it's like setting yourself up for failure, generate a kind heart towards yourself. Reflecting over just one day's activities can be painful, but you may end up respecting yourself more because you see that a lot happened. You weren't just one way. As Carl Jung said at the end of his life, "I'm astonished, disappointed, pleased with myself. I'm distressed, depressed, rapturous. I'm all these things at once and cannot add up the sum." So that's the big squeeze. Although you listen to all these teachings and you have all these practices as a support, somehow it has to become real for you. It has to be digested by you. The teachings and practices are like orange juice concentrate, that thick orange stuff in the can. And life is like the water. You have to mix it all together. Then you can have good orange juice that you can bring out in a big pitcher for everyone to drink. And even though it came out of a can, you know that it's truly freshly squeezed. Caitlin Hatch is a devotee of Pema Chodron, and on the website medium.com, she talks about how she has put Pema Chodron's advice into practice in an article from what she calls her Lojong practice journal. Lojong, by the way, is Tibetan for mind training. This is what she writes. "Pulling this slogan was a nice reminder of a practice tool I've studied regularly and trust to work. It's one with which I'm quite familiar, as I have a talk by Annie Pema Chodron where she goes over the three difficulties in great detail. I've even done a podcast on them. The difficulties are thus named as they are three things that we're not habituated to do. Even the most skilled and senior practitioner might find them challenging, as they involve us working with unconscious habits of perception. The first difficulty is to notice when we get hooked. Getting hooked is how Annie Pema described shempa. This is a word also translated as attachment. I appreciate Pema Chodron's translation, however, as there can be a lot of confusion around what attachment means. But getting hooked is pretty straightforward. When we get hooked, we're stuck on something, like a fish with a hook in its mouth. The situation might go our way, but even if we manage to escape the hook, we're rarely left unscathed. As already stated, self-deception runs deep. You have probably noticed this in other people. The friend who tells you they've really cut down on smoking as they light up a third cigarette since you met them up only an hour ago. The family member who says they're working out all the time and really taking care of themselves, so they're not sure why they're putting on weight, as they help themselves to a second slice of cake. The co-worker who is late every morning and you regularly see playing solitaire or on social media during working hours, complaining about not getting the promotion they deserve. Studies are proving how self-deception operates even in the face of hard facts. People given their statistical odds of future health risks will still rank themselves as the exceptions. Before passing judgment, it's important to note that this is not something to which we are immune, just because we can spot it easily in those around us. While it can be easy to spot in other people, and we can read study after study telling us that it's something all human beings do, no one is particularly good at noticing their patterns of self-deception, even when presented with proof. That's what makes this difficult. Training in the three difficulties requires a firm intention and motivation to wake up so we can begin to see our habits of self-deception. It can be a painful process, as it often means we will see things about ourselves that we don't consider to be good. But we also acknowledge that we can't work with or change the things we can't see. Which brings us to the second difficulty: do something different. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's not taking us further into self-deception. When Annie Pema teaches on this, she says she was given the instruction to do anything different at all, even if it's just standing on your head. The idea is to interrupt the habitual pattern. Our brains are malleable. Our actions and thoughts create pathways, neurological connections that get closer and closer together with habit. This can be a great thing, like when we're learning to drive. At first, the movements required and what we have to pay attention to will feel unfamiliar, even awkward. But over time, with repetition, we will get more comfortable with everything involved, from maintaining our speed to watching for pedestrians to following signs and lights. A lot of driving becomes habitual, something which we aren't even thinking about while we're doing it. Unfortunately, the same thing happens with behavior that causes harm or isn't of benefit. The more we resort to anger, for example, the shorter that pathway becomes. The quicker to anger we will be as time passes. Choosing to do something different is choosing not to strengthen habits that are unhelpful. As a reminder to do something different, I reflect on Pema Chodron's questions. In a year, do you want to be more quick to anger, more anxious, more stressed out? Or do you want to be calmer, saner and kinder, more compassionate and less fearful? My answer to the first two questions is consistently no, and that brings me to the third difficulty. The need to continually repeat this process so we can replace our less appealing habits with ones that don't cause harm. It would be great if we could notice ourselves getting hooked, do something different and be done with it. But those brain connections run deep. While the brain isn't rigid and nothing is hardwired, rewiring takes time. No one is just one driving lesson and walks away a perfect driver. By maintaining a longing to not cause harm and to be of the greatest benefit for all sentient beings, the three difficulties become a joy to practice. They may be difficult, but that doesn't make them something we do grudgingly. Once we've noticed a habit or pattern, interjected by doing something different, and repeated this process even three or four times, we will begin to see a change. We will see ourselves becoming more flexible, more curious about our thoughts, words, and actions. Also, as we do this, we will become less judgmental about the hooked qualities we see in other people. Working in this way is a humbling practice. We understand the temptation of self-deception in others by noticing it in ourselves. We can relate to them better and see how easy it is not to see all the ways we get hooked. And that is Caitlin Hatch on Medium.com. And now it's time to say farewell. I'm off to Wander India on an open one-way ticket, so this is where the programs on mind training like the rays of the sun are stopping. I'm sorry we couldn't complete the text, but maybe sometime on a return. However, repeats of previous programs will continue weekly while I'm away. Thank you for listening, and I sincerely hope that our programs have been of some benefit to you. Please dedicate as usual to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all, and thank you so much for everything. Go well, go safely, and go in peace. Goodbye.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.